Okay, so what's the legal disclaimer?
You gonna repeat it again?
Yeah.
Yeah, our opinions are our own.
Oh, not that one. But anyways, never mind. That.
Oh yeah, it's for educational and review purposes only.
There you go.
Yeah, I think so. We should put up links to that book on Amazon so people can get a hold of it. It's a nice little book.
Cool.
It'd be worth buying. So.
Cool.
And that would make him one of our advertisers if we could do an Amazon link where we could get some pay out of it.
I used to have one of those, but I don't anymore.
Yeah, I had one of those when I first started doing it.
Yeah,
I never got it off the ground.
I got ADD. I never stuck with it. I probably would have a lot of money right now if I did. Oh, well.
There you go. Alrighty.
Alright, party on.
Party on.
Okay, goodbye.
Bye.
Originally written in English, The Basic Laws of Human Stupidity was published for the first time in 1976 in a numbered and private edition bearing the unlikely imprint of Mad Miller's. The author believed that his short essay could only be fully appreciated in the language in which it had been written. He consequently long declined any proposal to have it translated. Only in 1988 did he accept the idea of its publication in an Italian version, as part of the volume, entitled Allegro, Ma Non Troppo, together with the essay Pepper, Wine and Wool as the Dynamic Factors of the Social and Economic Development of the Middle Ages, also originally written in English and published privately by Mad Millers for Christmas 1973. Allegro, Ma Non Troppo has been a bestseller both in Italy and in all the countries where translated versions have appeared. Yet, with an irony that the author of these laws would have appreciated, it has never been published in the language in which it was first written. The private edition of 1976 was preceded by the following publisher's note written by the author himself. The Mad Millers printed only a limited number of copies of this book, which addresses itself not to stupid people but to those who on occasion have to deal with such people. To add that none of those who will receive this book can possibly fall in area S of the basic graph figure 3 is therefore a work of supererogation. Nevertheless, like most works of supererogation, it is better done than left undone. Human affairs are admittedly in a deplorable state. This, however, is no novelty. As far back as we can see, human affairs have always been in a deplorable state. The heavy load of troubles and miseries that human beings have to bear as individuals as well as members of organized societies is basically a byproduct of the most improbable and, I would dare say, stupid way in which life was set up at its very inception. After Darwin, we know that we share our origin with the lower members of the animal kingdom, and worms, as well as elephants, have to bear their daily share of trials, predicaments, and ordeals. Human beings, however, are privileged in so far as they have to bear an extra load, an extra dose of tribulations originated daily by a group of people within the human race itself. This group is much more powerful than the mafia, or the military-industrial complex, or international communism. It is an unorganized and chartered group, which has no chief, no president, no bylaws, and yet manages to operate in perfect unison, as if guided by an invisible hand, in such a way that the activity of each member powerfully contributes to strengthen and amplify the effectiveness of the activity of all other members. The nature, character, and behavior of the members of this group are the subject of the following pages. The first basic law of human stupidity asserts without ambiguity that, at first, the statement sounds trivial, vague, and horribly ungenerous. Closer scrutiny will, however, reveal its realistic veracity. No matter how high are one's estimates of human stupidity, one is repeatedly and recurrently startled by the fact that cultural trends now fashionable in the West favor an egalitarian approach to life. People like to think of human beings as the output of a perfectly engineered mass production machine. geneticists and sociologists especially go out of their way to prove, with an impressive apparatus of scientific data and formulations, that all men are naturally equal, and if some are more equal than others, this is attributable to nurture and not to nature. I take an exception to this general view. It is my firm conviction, supported by years of observation and experimentation, that men are not equal, that some are stupid and others are not, and that the difference is determined by nature, and not by cultural forces or factors. One is stupid in the same way one is red-haired. One belongs to the stupid set as one belongs to a blood group. A stupid man is born a stupid man by an act of providence. Although convinced that fraction sigma of human beings are stupid and that they are so because of genetic traits, I am not a reactionary trying to reintroduce surreptitiously class or race discrimination. I firmly believe that stupidity is an indiscriminate privilege of all human groups and is uniformly distributed according to a constant proportion. This fact is scientifically expressed by the second basic law, which states that, in this regard, nature seems indeed to have outdone herself. It is well known that nature manages, rather mysteriously, to keep constant the relative frequency of certain natural phenomena. For instance, whether men proliferate at the northern pole or at the equator, whether the matching couples are developed or underdeveloped, whether they are black, red, white, or yellow, the female-to-male ratio among the newly born is a constant, with a very slight prevalence of males. We do not know how nature achieves this remarkable result, but we know that in order to achieve it, nature must operate with large numbers. The most remarkable fact about the frequency of stupidity is that nature succeeds in making this frequency equal to the probability sigma quite independently from the size of the group. Thus one finds the same percentage of stupid people whether one is considering very large groups or one is dealing with very small ones. No other set of observable phenomena offers such striking proof of the powers of nature. The evidence that education has nothing to do with the probability sigma was provided by experiments carried on in a large number of universities all over the world. One may distinguish the composite population which constitutes a university in five major groups, namely the blue-collar workers, the white-collar employees, the students, the administrators, and the professors. Whenever I analyzed the blue-collar workers, I found that the fraction sigma of them were stupid. As sigma S value was higher than I expected, first law, paying my tribute to fashion, I thought at first that segregation, poverty, lack of education were to be blamed. But moving up the social ladder, I found that the same ratio was prevalent among the white-collar employees and among the students. More impressive still were the results among the professors. Whether I considered a large university or a small college, a famous institution or an obscure one, I found that the same fraction sigma of the professors are stupid. So bewildered was I by the results that I made a special point to extend my research to a specially selected group, to a real elite, the Nobel laureates. The result confirmed nature's supreme powers. Sigma fraction of the Nobel laureates are stupid. At this point, it is imperative to elucidate the concept of human stupidity and to define the dramatis persona. Individuals are characterized by different degrees of propensity to socialize. There are individuals for whom any contact with other individuals is a painful necessity. They literally have to put up with people, and people have to put up with them. At the other extreme of the spectrum, there are individuals who absolutely cannot live by themselves and are even ready to spend time in the company of people whom they do not really like rather than to be alone. Between these two extremes, there is an extreme variety of conditions, although by far the greatest majority of the people are closer to the type who cannot face loneliness than to the type who has no taste for human intercourse. Aristotle recognized this fact when he wrote that man is a social animal, and the validity of his statement is demonstrated by the fact that we move in social groups, that there are more married people than bachelors and spinsters, that so much wealth and time is wasted in fatiguing and boring cocktail parties, and that the word loneliness carries normally a negative connotation. Whether one belongs to the hermit or to the socialite type, one deals with people, although with different intensity. Even the hermits occasionally meet people. Moreover, one affects human beings also by avoiding them. What I could have done for an individual or a group, but did not do, is an opportunity cost, i.e. a lost gain or loss for that particular person or group. The moral of the story is that each one of us has a current balance with everybody else. From action or inaction, each one of us derives a gain or a loss, and at the same time, one causes a gain or a loss to someone else. Gains and losses can be conveniently charted on a graph, and figure 3 shows the basic graph to be used for the purpose. The graph refers to an individual, let us say Tom. The x-axis measures the gain that Tom derives from his actions. On the y-axis, the graph shows the gain that another person or group of persons derive from Tom's actions. Gains can be positive, nil, or negative, a negative gain being actually a loss. The x-axis measures Tom's positive gains to the right of point O and Tom's losses to the left of point O. The y-axis measures the gains and losses of the person or persons with whom Tom dealt, respectively above and below point O. To make all this clear, let us make a hypothetical example and refer to figure 3. Tom takes an action which affects Dick. If Tom derives from the action a gain and Dick suffers from the same action a loss, the action will be recorded on the graph with a dot, which will appear in the graph somewhere in area B. The third basic law assumes, although it does not state it explicitly, that human beings fall into four basic categories: the helpless, the intelligent, the bandit, and the stupid. It will be easily recognized by the perspicacious reader that these four categories correspond to the four areas H, I, B, S of the basic graph. See figure 3. If Tom takes an action and suffers a loss while producing a gain to Dick, Tom's mark will fall in field. Tom acted helplessly. If Tom takes an action by which he makes a gain while yielding a gain also to Dick, Tom's mark will fall in area E. Tom acted intelligently. If Tom takes an action by which he makes a gain causing Dick a loss, Tom's mark will fall in area B. Tom acted as a bandit. Stupidity is related to area S and to all positions on axis Y below point O, as the third basic law explicitly clarifies. Most people do not act consistently. Under certain circumstances, a given person acts intelligently, and under different circumstances, the same person will act helplessly. The only important exception to the rule is represented by the stupid people, who normally show a strong proclivity toward perfect consistency in all fields of human endeavors. From all that proceeds, it does not follow that we can chart on the basic graph only stupid individuals. We can calculate for each person his weighted average position in the plane of figure 3 quite independently from his degree of inconsistency. A helpless person may occasionally behave intelligently, and on occasion he may perform a bandit's action. But since the person in question is fundamentally helpless, most of his action will have the characteristics of helplessness. Thus, the overall weighted average position of all the actions of such a person will place him in the H quadrant of the basic graph. The fact that it is possible to place on the graph individuals instead of their actions allows some digression about the frequency of the bandit and stupid types. The perfect bandit is one who, with his actions, causes to other individuals losses equal to his gains. The crudest type of banditry is theft. A person who robs you of £100 without causing you an extra loss or harm is a perfect bandit. You lose £100, he gains £100. In the basic graph, the perfect bandits would appear on a 45-degree diagonal line that divides the area B into two perfectly symmetrical sub-areas, line M of figure 5. However, the perfect bandits are relatively few. The line M divides the area B into two sub-areas, by and BS, and by far the largest majority of the bandits falls somewhere in one of these two sub-areas. The bandits who fall in area by are those individuals whose actions yield to them profits which are larger than the losses they cause to other people. All bandits who are entitled to a position in area BS are bandits with overtones of intelligence, and as they get closer to the right side of the x-axis, they share more and more the characteristics of the intelligent person. Unfortunately, the individuals entitled to a position in the BI area are not very numerous. Most bandits actually fall in area BS. The individuals who fall in this area are those whose actions yield to them gains inferior to the losses inflicted to other people. If someone kills you in order to rob you of £50, or if he murders you in order to spend a weekend with your wife at Monte Carlo, we can be sure that he is not a perfect bandit. Even by using his values to measure his gains, but still using your values to measure your losses, he falls in the BS area, very close to the border of sheer stupidity. Generals who cause vast destruction and innumerable casualties in return for a promotion or a medal fall in the same area. The frequency distribution of the stupid people is totally different from that of the bandit. While bandits are mostly scattered over an area, stupid people are heavily concentrated along one line, specifically, on the y-axis below point O. The reason for this is that by far the majority of stupid people are basically and unwaveringly stupid. In other words, they perseveringly insist in causing harm and losses to other people without deriving any gain, whether positive or negative. Like all human creatures, stupid people vary enormously in their capacity to affect their fellow men. Some stupid people normally cause only limited losses, while others egregiously succeed in causing ghastly and widespread damages not only to one or two individuals but to entire communities or societies. The damaging potential of the stupid person depends on two major factors. First of all, it depends on the genetic factor. Some individuals inherit exceptional doses of the gene of stupidity, and by virtue of inheritance they belong from birth to the elite of their group. The second factor which determines the potential of a stupid person is related to the position of power and consequence which he occupies in society. Among bureaucrats, generals, politicians, and heads of state, one has little difficulty in finding clear examples of basically stupid individuals whose damaging capacity was or is alarmingly enhanced by the position of power which they occupied or occupy. Religious dignitaries should not be overlooked. The question that reasonable people often raise is how and why stupid people can reach positions of power and consequence. It is not difficult to understand how social, political, and institutional power enhances the damaging potential of a stupid person, but one still has to explain and understand what essentially it is that makes a stupid person dangerous to other people. In other words, what constitutes the power of stupidity. Essentially, stupid people are dangerous and damaging because reasonable people find it difficult to imagine and understand unreasonable behavior. An intelligent person may understand the logic of a bandit. The bandit's actions follow a pattern of rationality, nasty rationality, if you like, but still rationality. The bandit wants a plus on his account. Since he is not intelligent enough to devise ways of obtaining the plus as well as providing you with a plus, he will produce his plus by causing a minus to appear on your account. All this is bad, but it is rational, and if you are rational, you can predict it. You can foresee a bandit's actions, his nasty maneuvers and ugly aspirations, and often can build up your defenses. With a stupid person, all this is absolutely impossible, as explained by the third basic law. A stupid creature will harass you for no reason, for no advantage, without any plan or scheme, and at the most improbable times and places. You have no rational way of telling if and when and how and why the stupid creature attacks. When confronted with a stupid individual, you are completely at his mercy. Because the stupid person's actions do not conform to the rules of rationality, it follows that helpless people, namely those who in our accounting system fall into the H area, do not normally recognize how dangerous stupid people are, is not at all surprising. Their failure is just another expression of their helplessness. The truly amazing fact, however, is that also, intelligent people and bandits often fail to recognize the power to damage inherent in stupidity. It is extremely difficult to explain why this should happen, and one can only remark that when confronted with stupid individuals, often intelligent men, as well as bandits, make the mistake of indulging in feelings of self-complacency and contemptuousness instead of immediately secreting adequate quantities of adrenaline and building up defenses. One is tempted to believe that a stupid man will only do harm to himself, but this is confusing stupidity with helplessness. On occasion, one is tempted to associate oneself with a stupid individual in order to use him for one's own schemes. Such a maneuver cannot but have disastrous effects, because one may hope to outmaneuver the stupid, and up to a point, one may actually do so. But because of the erratic behavior of the stupid, one cannot foresee all the stupid's actions and reactions, and before long one will be pulverized by the unpredictable moves of the stupid partner. This is clearly summarized in the fourth basic law, which states that the consideration on which the previous chapter ends is conducive to a macro type of analysis, in which, instead of considering the welfare of the individual, one considers the welfare of the society, regarded in this context as the algebraic sum of the individual conditions. A full understanding of the fifth basic law is essential to the analysis. It may be parenthetically added here that of the five basic laws, the fifth is certainly the best known, and its corollary is quoted very frequently. The fifth basic law states that the corollary of the law is that the formulation of the law and its corollary is still of the micro type. As indicated above, however, the law and its corollary have far-reaching implications of a macro nature. The essential point to keep in mind is this: the result of the action of a perfect bandit, the person who falls on line of figure 5 or figure 6 below, is purely and simply a transfer of wealth and slash or welfare. After the action of a perfect bandit, the bandit has a plus on his account, which plus is exactly equivalent to the minus he has caused to another person. The society as a whole is neither better nor worse off. If all members of a society were perfect bandits, the society would remain stagnant, but there would be no major disaster. The whole business would amount to massive transfers of wealth and welfare in favor of those who would take action. If all members of the society would take action in regular turns, not only the society as a whole, but also individuals would find themselves in a perfectly steady state of no change. When stupid people are at work, the story is totally different. Stupid people cause losses to other people with no counterpart of gains on their own account. Thus, the society as a whole is impoverished. The system of accounting, which finds expression in the basic graphs, shows that while all actions of individuals falling to the right of the line palm C figure 6 add to the welfare of a society, although in different degrees, the actions of all individuals falling to the left of the same line palm cause a deterioration. In other words, the helpless with overtones of intelligence area high, the bandits with overtones of intelligence area I, and above all the intelligent area I, all contribute, though in different degrees, to accrue to the welfare of a society. On the other hand, the bandits with overtones of stupidity area BS and the helpless with overtones of stupidity area S manage to add losses to those caused by stupid people, thus enhancing the nefarious destructive power of the latter group. All this suggests some reflection on the performance of societies. According to the second basic law, the fraction of stupid people is a constant sigma, which is not affected by time, space, race, class, or any other sociocultural or historical variable. It would be a profound mistake to believe the number of stupid people in a declining society is greater than in a developing society. Both such societies are plagued by the same percentage of stupid people. The difference between the two societies is that in the society which performs poorly, this theoretical presumption is abundantly confirmed by an exhaustive analysis of historical cases. In fact, the historical analysis allows us to reformulate the theoretical conclusions in a more factual way and with more realistic detail. Whether one considers classical, or medieval, or modern, or contemporary times, one is impressed by the fact that any country moving uphill has its unavoidable sigma fraction of stupid people. However, the country moving uphill also has an unusually high fraction of intelligent people who manage to keep the sigma fraction at bay and at the same time produce enough gains for themselves and the other members of the community to make progress a certainty. In a country which is moving downhill, the fraction of stupid people is still equal to sigma. However, in the remaining population, one notices among those in power an alarming proliferation of the bandits with overtones of stupidity sub-area BS of quadrant B in figure 6, and among those not in power an equally alarming growth in the number of helpless individuals area H in basic graph figure 3. Such change in the composition of the non-stupid population inevitably strengthens the destructive power of the sigma fraction and makes decline a certainty. As a young man, Cipolla wanted to teach history and philosophy in an Italian high school, and therefore enrolled at the political science faculty at Pavia University. Whilst a student there, thanks to Professor Franco Borlandi, a specialist in medieval economic history, he discovered his passion for economic history. Subsequently, he studied at the Sorbonne and the London School of Economics. Cipolla obtained his first teaching post in economic history in Catania at the age of 27. This was to be the first stop in a long academic career in Italy, Venice, Turin, Pavia, Scuola Normale Superiore di Pisa, and Fiesole, and abroad. In 1953, Cipolla left for the United States as a Fulbright Fellow, and in 1957 became a visiting professor at the University of California, Berkeley. 2 years later, he obtained a full professorship. One of Cipolla's works is a collection of two tongue-in-cheek essays on economics, circulated in English among friends in 1973 and 1976, then published in 1988 in Italian under the title Allegro ma non troppo, forward but not too fast, happy but not too much, from the musical Quickly but not too quick. ISBN 978-88-23381-3.
Ah, I only read 15 pages. See if we can do that again.
Originally written in...
Okay, I guess that's it. We'll have to get the book.